If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is Scott. I am joined by Steven. Say hi, Steven.
Hi, Steven.
Well, that is the first and last time you will ever use that joke on this show. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You're like my grandfather for a second. All right, Steven, you are a doctor of science, and there's nothing you hate more than errors that are uncorrected. And you made an error last week, and you said, remind me to correct it, and here I am.
I made a really dumb error. I made a dumb error that I should be ashamed of, and I am, because it's in my field of expertise, and I completely screwed it up. So at one point, we were talking about how far Clendathu, the bug planet, was from the sun based on this diagram of the galaxy that they showed, and I repeatedly used the figure 14,000 light years. The actual entire diameter of the galaxy is something closer to 150 to 200,000 light years. The actual distance of the solar system from the center of the galaxy is closer to 26,000 light years, which would make Clendathu roughly twice that, or 50-ish thousand light years. Now, the reason why I got this wrong, the reason why I screwed it up, and why I picked 14 is because I was thinking of kiloparsecs.
Of course. And that's why I didn't correct you, because I also assumed kiloparsecs.
I apologize to all of the science nerds out there who were going, wait a second. But yeah, I screwed that up.
We are here to talk about two interesting monster movies. And to me, they're interesting because, well, the first thing that's interesting about them, Steven, is that neither of them are Japanese. And the Japanese are the kings and the queens of the kaiju film. Godzilla hit in 1954 and created now a 30-some film running series. They also did Rodan and Varan the Unbelievable and Mothra. And there were other companies that did Gamera. And so Japanese filmmakers pretty much own the kaiju format. And our matchup for today is Cloverfield from 2008 versus The Host from 2006. And Steven, why don't you briefly explain why you wanted to do Cloverfield?
So first of all, I wanted to show that, you know, we won't just be talking about space movies here on Science versus Fiction. Obviously, my expertise is in astronomy, astrophysics, space science. But as a scientist, a lot of what you do is about learning how to think about things and how to judge evidence and how to evaluate things with a scientific mindset. And so it doesn't necessarily limit you to only doing the things that you are an expert in. So I wanted to do something that had some other kind of science in it that wasn't just astronomy. And this seemed like a good matchup.
And it's also a good opportunity since it is an impactful and influential found footage movie. It gives us a chance to plug our movie, Found Footage 3D, now available on Shudder, as are Cloverfield and The Host. Correct,
that
Steven?
That is correct. And if you are a horror fan and you don't already subscribe to Shudder, you should do so. And this is not a paid plug. This is purely out of the appreciation that we have for the service.
Absolutely. If Shudder wants to pay us to be an episode-by-episode sponsor, we will gladly take their endorsement. But that is an honest plug. They it's not just because it's horror. There's lots of things that are just horror, and they're good or not so good. Shudder is curated by people who know horror. I know a handful of the people who work there, and these people know what they're doing. They're serious horror junkies.
Of course they do, because they chose our movie, Found Footage 3D, as a Shudder exclusive.
Yes. Yep. So Cloverfield, this is a film directed by Matt Reeves, who after this would go on, he would kind of blow up and become a genre favorite. Prior to this, he had written The Yards. He had written and directed The Pallbearer, not so great. He had written Under Siege 2, And then after Cloverfield, he did the fantastic Let Me In, the excellent Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and the even better War for the Planet of the Apes.
And he is now working on The Batman with Robert Pattinson.
So, you know, Cloverfield being a hit afforded Matt Reeves a career that has benefited all of us because the man makes good movies.
Drew Goddard as well, the writer.
Yep, I was just about to move over to Drew Goddard, who the screenwriter, this was his debut. He did a lot of television, but after this, he wrote and directed Cabin in the Woods. He adapted World War Z. He adapted The Martian. And he recently did a strange film that has a loyal following called Bad Times at the El Royale, which I didn't love, but it's definitely interesting.
It is.
and so it's nice to see that looking back at Cloverfield, some of the cast went on to bigger things, some didn't, but the writer and the director sure did, and good stuff too. You know, not just they went on to bigger and better things, but really good film.
So let's talk about the movie for a second, the plot of the movie.
All right. What is Cloverfield about, Steven?
So it is about a kaiju attack, a monster attack in southern Manhattan. A group of, I would say, somewhat disposable and not particularly well differentiated young 20 somethings are having a party that is a going away party for their friend, played by Michael Stahl David. A friend of his is videotaping going away testimonials, as they say in the movie, like 15 times. Oh, I'm documenting. Oh, it's like a wedding. I'm getting reactions from everybody to say goodbye to Rob because he's leaving to go live in Japan.
Now, I know this is a favorite nitpick for you because you wrote and directed a found footage movie. Steven, in the first act of a movie, how many times do you need to establish the rules for why the person is holding the camera? Because as you said, this movie does it about a dozen times.
Yeah, no, it really, like, and then they switch camera guys at one point, and then they have to reestablish why that camera guy is now shooting everything. I'm going to give this movie a pass on a lot of that stuff just because it was so early in the found footage boom. A lot of the things, it struck me a lot watching it this time that a lot of the things that bug me about found footage movies today are here in this movie, but they weren't at that point, like, hadn't solidified into cliches. I think you could get away with some of the stuff that they pull in this movie in terms of, you know, justifying why the cameras just barely.
All right, I cut off your plot synopsis. So they're justifying why he's holding the camera, and go on.
And then monster attacks and destroys the Statue of Liberty, the giant Statue of Liberty head, which many people, even people who haven't seen the movie, will probably remember the shot from the trailer where the head of the Statue of Liberty lands on the street out in front of them. Mm-hmm. And the monster starts attacking, and then they have to get out of Manhattan. So their first goal is to get out of Manhattan, and then they realize that one of their number is stuck in her apartment, Rob's sometimes girlfriend, friend, sex buddy person.
Odette Yustman.
Odette Annable is, I believe, her name now.
Yeah.
And so they have to go back and try to rescue her. And it's very clear why Rob wants to do that. It's not nearly as clear to me why any of the other people go along with him.
Yeah, and it's laden with monster movie cliches. But and I was discussing the movie recently on Twitter with people, and somebody informed me, this may be apocryphal, it may be accurate, I don't know. But I was informed on Twitter that in the original cut of the film, in test screenings, the Statue of Liberty head was normal size, and people thought that it looked oddly small. So they bulked it up for the movie so that it would look more like epic in the movie. And again, it's not, you know, that kind of speaks to what we talk about in this show, like reality versus pure fiction. And so my question to you is, as a producer, if somebody said 70% of the test audience said that the head looks too small and we want to make it bigger, what would your argument be? Yes,
of course,
or no?
Yes. I mean, like, to me, like, the emotional experience that you're bringing your audience on is more important than fidelity to reality, as long as doing it doesn't pull people out of the movie. And in this case, I don't think it would.
Right.
I mean, anybody really has a sense of how big the Statue of Liberty's head is. Obviously, we don't, because that many people thought it looked too small.
Too small. Can we have a quick sidebar into things that we don't like that the Statue of Liberty does in movies? In Ghostbusters 2, all right, they climb inside the Statue of Liberty, and within the realm of the movie, we buy that this goo makes inanimate objects move. okay, I'm willing to buy that. I'm willing to buy it makes the toaster jump around and it makes the Statue of Liberty move a little bit. But, like, the structure still wouldn't bend and move like a human being would. It would just...
And you can't use a Nintendo controller to, like, make its legs move.
It would shatter the physics of the metal. Don't flow like a robe.
Yeah.
They would crack and fall apart. It doesn't make... So... I'm like, that kind of speaks to what we're talking about in this show, which is I'm willing to buy that this goo makes metal move. I'm not willing to buy that metal now moves as if it's a cloth.
Yeah.
That doesn't make physical sense. And who cares? Because it's Ghostbusters 2, but it's so crap. But it bothered me when I was 14 and it bothers me now. Damn.
So anyway, back to Cloverfield.
Back to Cloverfield. What I like about Cloverfield the most is obviously Reeves teases us a lot. It's that old school of let's show you a little, here's the monster's leg and now here's part of its belly and now it's him, here's the arm picking up a boat. And now here's the eye, and then later in the film, here it is in all its glory.
Which, the first part of that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, in a found footage movie, you're only sort of seeing what the characters see through his camera. And, you know, this guy, for as much as they establish that this dude doesn't have any idea how a camera works, he's awfully good at, like, managing to catch every important moment with the camera.
Right.
But that gets especially bad in the second half, where it's like, hold on, monster, I need to get a nice, good, perfectly framed up, from below shot of your entire face right before you kill me, because obviously, I'd still be thinking about composition at that point.
This guy would, dead or alive, he would have won the Pulitzer for photography, without question.
That's the thing, right? Because, again, because it goes out of its way. So, you know, I'm going to get off on a little bit of a high horse about found footage, but it's one of the things that bugs me. Because, obviously, he's shooting all of this stuff. There are parts where the military comes in, and he's shooting as the military's, like, shooting and firing bombs at it, and everything is all framed up beautifully. And you can believe that, like, an experienced war photographer might be able to actually pull that off and would be willing to pull it off because that's their job and, you know, they've been in those kinds of situations before. So, like, I get that they wanted just sort of these random 20-somethings or whatever and this feel of like, oh, they're just a bunch of schlubs. But at the same time, like, you could establish a backstory of this guy, like, I don't know, having some experience operating, like, literally any experience operating a camera instead of constantly reinforcing, like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. And then beautiful cinematography all the way through.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. How hard would it have been to be like, why are you shooting this whole party? What are you talking about? I work for the local news. I record everything.
Well, there's a moment where Lizzie Kaplan's character asks him for his card because she thinks that he's a professional videographer and he has to disabuse her of that notion.
My favorite character in the movie. Lizzie Kaplan is the, for me, is the cynical audience surrogate because she's the one who's kind of just not buying these right. people. And one of the biggest complaints about this movie, and we're not here to talk about other people's complaints, but it's hard to avoid when you discuss this movie, is that most of the characters are unlikable.
I wouldn't even say they're unlikable. They're just kind of...
obnoxious?
Yeah, they're just not interesting at all. Like, there's nothing differentiating them. They just seem like a bunch of kind of 20th-something, you know.
Now, you wrote a movie in which, you know, six of your characters are going to die. And as you're writing it, how do you do the balance? Let's give you a little, just a quick little screenwriting lesson. How do you write that balance of, well, I know this character's going to die, but I want the audience to like him, but I don't want the audience to fall in love with them because that...
Oh, no, I absolutely want the audience to fall in love with them. I want their heart to break. Like, to me, like, the essence of horror... good horror is characters that you care about in peril.
And now, do you care about the lion's share of these characters?
No.
Do you care?
No, not at all. And then, you know, that's fine. It's spectacle. It's not like, I mean, I kind of cared a little bit about Michael Stahl David's character. I thought he was, you know, I thought all the acting was competent and it worked in the context of, you know, this found footage, oh, these are real people kind of thing. But no, I mean, none of the characters were... They kind of, you know, they do spend the first 15 minutes kind of yelling at each other quite a bit. And
well, I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the editorial cheat or clever trick, depending on what you think, of having like older footage stuck in that camera? So it's we're getting this kind of B story about them in their happier times.
Oh, I like that. I thought that was a very clever way to give us some reason to care about those two characters, at least, even if we didn't give a shit about any of the other ones.
One thing that's really fun to talk about this movie is its marketing campaign. Boy, oh boy, is Bad Robot, and that's J.J. Abrams' production company. Boy, oh boy, are they good at dropping little clues, little tidbits, little pop culture, weird little iconography to get people talking. And man, people talked about, what is this movie? What does Cloverfield mean? And you know, we're here to talk about the quality of the movie, and I think we both agree that this is a fun monster movie, and a lot of it works because it, I think the novelty of the found footage makes it, you know, we have two very well-known subgenres or formats here, which is the kaiju story, we all know that, and found footage, we all know that. To have the two combined is kind of unique.
And again, like, this was one of the first movies to do that. Like, prior to this, you had Paranormal Activity, you had Blair Witch Project. There was a smattering of other sort of smaller ones, but those were the two sort of biggest ones that had come out yet. And I remember thinking very clearly, I was watching War of the Worlds, the Tom Cruise one, in the theater, and looking at, you know, all the cool CGI in that, and thinking, why doesn't somebody do like a found footage movie with really amazing CGI in it? And then, I don't know when it was a couple months later, maybe a year later, that the trailer for this came out, and I was like, holy shit, there it is. They did it. They're going to do it. After this, of course, Hollywood mined every single possible subgenre of horror and made it found footage. Horror, you know, found footage zombie movie, found footage Rosemary's Baby, found footage vampire movie. Literally, if you name a subgenre of horror over the next decade, somebody did it.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the first. And so there's a lot of stuff, again, that I think got ripped off from this. And so sort of similar to what I said last week about Aliens, where you feel when you rewatch the movie now, like you want to sort of judge it in the context of all of these things that then sort of ossified as cliches, you know?
Man, I'll tell you, that's one of the things that, like, writing about film for all these years and even before I started writing about films is you really, and I know you know this, but maybe to people just as a reminder, try to watch a film in the time in which it was made. And that goes for, like, its special effects. That goes for its cultural statements, as in, like, you know, I watch a lot of 80s films in which they make jokes that would never pass muster today, but you can't judge it on the realm of 2019. You have to judge Bachelor Party on the realm of 1985. That's not,
yeah,
you know what I mean? It wasn't made in 2019. And another way to look at it is, like you said, so many movies ripped off The Matrix. So what if you saw 70% of those movies before you ever saw The Matrix, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened with Cloverfield is so much of the clever ideas and the clever cinematography with the found footage approach was done here and in Paranormal and in Blair Witch and then was done over and over and over in lesser films.
Right.
And it's fun to see it with fresh eyes. I haven't seen this in 7 or 8 years.
I haven't seen this since the theater.
Yeah, and it was a blast. I had a really good time. Did you have any motion sickness issues with this film?
No, I rarely do. I remember actually, I remember seeing it in the theater having a little bit of an issue with it. I didn't this time on a smaller screen.
It's very shaky.
Yeah.
And you know, you made a movie that has a lot of shaky in it too. How do you avoid overtaxing your audience's eyeballs and equilibrium?
I mean, we made a very careful effort to make sure that we weren't shaking the camera too much, that we were shooting it in ways that were not just completely chaotic. And when the movie does get to the climax to where you can't avoid that, we had the split screen thing, and I choreographed that thing very, very carefully so that there was almost always a still frame and a shaky frame. And so anybody who didn't want to look at the shaky frame could look at the still one and avoid the motion sickness.
In Cloverfield, it's made clear late in the game that it comes from outer space.
Right.
It does not come from under the sea. It is an alien.
Well, I missed that the first time I saw the movie. People told me about it as I was leaving the theater, and I was like, oh, huh. And I almost missed it this time.
Give me the scientific notebook on Cloverfield. Go ahead.
Well, so there's that last shot, the final shot of the movie, you sort of in the way deep background as they're on this Ferris wheel or whatever on Coney Island in the past footage that was already on the camera before they recorded the new footage. Anyway, you see this thing drop out of the sky and land in the water. And so presumably this thing comes from space and it lands in the water. Now, again, you can't have it be this big dramatic thing or people would have noticed that it landed then and then the whole story wouldn't have necessarily happened. But it is a little bit under dramatic in terms of if this thing actually did fly down from outer space in some way. When things enter the Earth's atmosphere, they get very, very hot. And so, you know, if you ever actually see a meteor through the sky, it's a giant flaming fireball. And when it lands, if it lands, it kicks up a whole lot of stuff.
Okay, so what you're saying is in the movie, it looks like it falls out of the sky like something from 300 feet up.
Exactly. It looks like it jumped out of a plane or something.
Like an expended flare or something. It just plop, you know.
Right.
And your argument would be, I get that you want it to be landing in the background discreetly, but it would still have a trail of some sort.
Well, but that also then leads to a broader question of, okay, well, how did it get here? Like, what is this thing's life cycle? How was it? Did it come in a spaceship? I presume not. It doesn't seem like it has that kind of intelligence.
If you and I are, if we were, you know, lucky enough to make this movie, and you and I are cutting it together at the last minute, and you say to me, I got this little meteorite landing in the water. Keep it or cut it?
Keep it.
Why? What does it need? Why do you need it? Why is it?
It's a cool little sort of Easter egg explanation for what's happening, you know, and the idea that they were there at the beginning of this thing and didn't notice it is kind of a neat sort of thing.
Okay.
But again, from a scientific point of view, it brings up the questions for me of like, okay, well, did this thing, is it literally just sort of been floating around in outer space and somehow didn't die? Or, you know, it had some sort of seed that was floating around in outer space and then what, it got activated when it hit the Earth? Or like, a lot of that stuff is sort of interesting to sort of think about. And in that sense, I feel like the sequels almost sort of muddy the waters a little bit.
Well, all right, to those who might not know, the sequels, quote unquote, they're semi-sequels, in that both of the films that follow this one were not Cloverfield films. They were just different thrillers, one an underground bunker thriller and the other a space station thriller. And they kind of got the Cloverfield DNA grafted onto them in post-production. And I'm fine with that. I think it's kind of a clever idea as long as you have a good film to graft your franchise onto. If they're good films, go ahead and do it.
10 Cloverfield Lane is definitely a good film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like the second one. I don't dislike the third one, but I don't think I really get it. And if we do this show for 7 or 8 years, maybe we'll get to the Cloverfield paradox.
I'm sure we will.
So what else is there, Doctor, science-wise in Cloverfield?
Well, so there's a little bit of physics stuff that is interesting. I mean, I love the design of the monster. It has these sort of bat-like creatures. You know, they decided clearly as an aesthetic choice that they were going to go with something that was kind of like spindly and, you know, has these big, long, skinny legs instead of like the traditional, like, you know, you think of Godzilla, you think of King Kong, you think of this big, squat, barrel-chested, like.
No, I agree. In a similar vein, I love that epic, like, Daddy Long Legs from Kong Skull Island. Mm-hmm. I love, and that's just so freaky and bizarre. And yeah, I think you're right. I love the design of this creature.
So the problem with designing this monster as this big sort of spindly thing as opposed to a squat, you know, powerful sort of thing is the physics of it don't make any sense anymore.
It couldn't carry its own weight, right?
Couldn't carry its own weight, exactly. So there's a reason why elephants have these giant legs and mice and insects have little sort of skinny legs is because the larger you scale something, to get sort of a little bit technical about it, and I hope this isn't too wonky for people, but mass, which is you know, how weight a thing has to carry, scales with the cube of the length. So in other words, like if you make something twice as big, it has 8 times as much mass. But strength, like the strength of a limb, is based on cross-sectional area. So it only goes up as the square. So if you made something 3 times as big, it would have 8 times as much weight, but only be 4 times as strong.
Gotcha. So if you made my torso 10 times heavier, you couldn't just make my legs 10 times stronger. You'd have to make them 40 times stronger.
Well, you'd have to make them 10 times stronger, but you couldn't make them 10 times bigger.
Right.
Because 10 times bigger wouldn't make them 10 times stronger. It would make them less than that.
Got it.
So in this case, you have this giant thing that's 40 stories tall that's on these sort of little skinny legs. And again, if you imagine an elephant trying to walk around with a deer's legs, it's not going to work. It's going to break its legs the first time it takes a step, and that's the end of that thing. So that doesn't, you know, from a physics point of view, that doesn't make sense. But again, you know, you're watching a monster movie. You don't care while you're watching the movie.
Right. And again, you as a scientist, as a film nut, none of the quote-unquote questionable science in Cloverfield hurts the film. Nothing in it makes you go, oh, come on!
No, I mean, I think that the questionable decision to keep filming everything hurt the movie more than any
well, yeah,
of the
you'd have
science.
To talk to a psychiatrist then. You're not a psychiatrist, Jim. You're a scientist. All right, let's go back 2 years to a 2006 Korean film that was a huge hit in its native country and earned fans everywhere it went. It played at festivals all over the world.
Couldn't can.
I think I saw it at Fantastic Fest, I believe, and like most horror fans and genre fans, I fell madly in love with Bong Joon-ho's The Host.
Wait, Wait, that was the one we were supposed to watch?
Oh, did you watch the teen young adult that saved like the world against
the Twilight one with like the, that was basically like a young adult romance ripoff of Body Snatchers?
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. DeGennaro.
I was wondering why we were putting these two movies together. It didn't really make any sense to me.
It's all shtick. This is a doctor trying to do comedy. It's a comedy shtick. Nope, it is not that host. It is the South Korean masterpiece, the host. And I'll do the plot for this one. I'll keep it real simple. A wonderfully dysfunctional family kicks it into gear with teamwork when their youngest member, a plucky little girl, is abducted by a giant fish tadpole monster. It's funny, it's political, it's social commentary, it's legitimately a monster movie, it's suspenseful, scary, it's every genre at once.
Heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, yeah. I mean, it's a meal of a movie. I absolutely love, I like Cloverfield, but I love The Host.
Within the first 5 minutes of this movie, you're already aware that you're watching a better movie.
I love how in every, not every, but in so many 50s monster movies, you have in the prologue some form of irresponsible act or you know, corporate espionage or biological malfeasance, dumping of toxic waste or something that will show up in Act Two. And Bong Joon-ho knows this. And Steven, how does he set up the first sequence in the movie?
So it's apparently an American military doctor, and he instructs his assistant to pour a bunch of formaldehyde down the drain.
200 bottles!
Yeah, which, you know, not to get too far ahead of ourselves from a scientific point of view, that's kind of silly that would cause this massive mutated monster. But
here's my main question. What does formaldehyde do?
Formaldehyde is actually a naturally occurring chemical. It does lots of different things. We mainly use it sort of in an industrial scale as a preservative. It's what you embalm. I mean, you can preserve things in it. When you see like little, you know, cow fetuses in a jar on a scientist's shelf, it's probably formaldehyde or some formaldehyde-based solution that it's in. It's toxic.
And it's also, like you mentioned, it's the key component in embalming fluid, right?
Yes.
And also, not something to put on an ice cream sundae.
No.
Okay.
You know, it's poisonous. You see, in that early scene, you see him wearing the gas mask because the fumes coming off of formaldehyde are highly,
yeah, they're toxic.
They're not like, oh, you're going to die instantly. But it's generally a bad idea to be breathing them in.
Oh, and you know, one of my favorite things are his reason. Not only is it insipid and horrible to dump formaldehyde down a normal sink drain pipe, but his reason for doing so is because the bottles are dusty. He runs his finger across the bottle and he's like, oh, God, better dump all these because they're old and the bottles are dusty? What? It's just another, like, you know, flat piece of, and I mean flat as a compliment in this case, another very flat piece of satire.
Yeah, it's a very
experiment time. If I had a swimming pool, not chlorine, a natural seawater, and I filled it with fish of all sorts, and then I dumped 200 bottles of formaldehyde into that pool, how long would it take to make a host monster?
3.8 deca-years. I don't know. I mean, it would just kill the fish. It wouldn't.
This kind of speaks to the backbone of the show. You know, as a scientist, I know as a film nut, and Bong Joon-ho knows as a writer-director, that formaldehyde would not do that to fish. But it doesn't matter. It's cause and effect in a sci-fi horror film. Like, the actual science doesn't matter, and it's funny.
It is a weird choice, though, because, I mean, it did jump out at me as being like, well, why make it formaldehyde, which is a chemical that, you know, at least a lot of people are fairly familiar with, even if they don't know exactly what it is. They've heard the term before. But, like, you could make up a chemical that, you know, has some sort of mutagenic properties.
But maybe it's that familiarity that makes the joke so funny. When you're like, wait, formaldehyde, I've heard of that. That's dangerous. And then you see him dumping all those jars in the sink.
Yeah, but he's dumping it into one of the largest rivers in Korea. And like even, you know, 20 bottles is is nothing compared to the
well, it's 200.
Whatever it is. It's
I love the tracking shot over all the bottles, but just showing how long he's done it. And again, it's just a flat, matter-of-fact piece of satire about American, not necessarily just American, but in this case, American military ignorance, just dump this poison into a water supply.
Well, so after that happens, you know, we have the scene introducing the family, and it's done remarkably efficiently, but immediately you understand and care about these characters, even the guy who's kind of a bit of a doofus. And that's, you know, a testament to the performances and to the writing.
In a nutshell, it's about a really colorful extended family, five people who run afoul of a freakishly giant tadpole monster. And the family has to team together to go and rescue the young girl. And it goes to some really funny, sad, bizarre places. And to say a whole lot would spoil a lot of the dark surprises. Steven, you know what my very favorite thing about this movie is?
What?
The matter-of-fact way in which the monster is presented. It's not a big crescendo and you're waiting for it to burst from the water and it climbs out majestically. It's like, oh, shit, what's that behind that girl? Yep. Oh, my God! Yeah. And it's like there, hovering in the background, and it like when it first starts stampeding down the runway towards all these people, you're like, get out of the way. Get out of the way. It's like, it's one of those movies where you're constantly yelling at the characters, and Bong Joon-ho knows that, and he's having so much fun with the monster side. I mean, there's a lot more fun to be had, but just with the monster stuff, he is playing his audience like a violin.
Well, so there are so many moments in this that are very Korean. They're very Asian-inspired storytelling. There are a lot of things in it that no American blockbuster would ever even attempt, much less succeed at. The first one for me was, so the daughter gets kidnapped, and so her father and her grandfather and aunt and uncle are in this shelter, you know, after the first initial monster attack, and they think that she's dead, and, you know, they have this big wall full of the pictures of all the people that died in the attack, and she's up there, and they start bawling their eyes out in front of this picture to the point where they end up on the floor. They're grabbing one another. They're like, and just this comically over-exaggerated outpouring of grief that is simultaneously like really touching, but also really hilarious. And to be able to get away with that sort of moment, which is, hey, our daughter, granddaughter is dead, and we're going to play it for laughs and to succeed at it, is a bold choice.
I'm not even sure I fully get that joke. Is it a mockery of overacting melodrama? Is that what it is?
I don't know that the joke is anything beyond this is sort of a little bit of funny physical comedy.
Okay.
But it works because it feels very grounded in character, and it's not.
But if that happened in a comedic horror film from America, you'd be like, oh, they're clearly mocking like the standard. Oh, like if somebody was playing in a Halloween satire and they were overplaying Dr. Loomis, you'd be like, all right, well, Donald Pleasance kind of overacted a lot. That's the joke they're playing, is that in these movies, there's overacting and over-emoting and maybe, or even bad acting, you know, maybe that, I don't know. I don't get the joke, but I love it. I do think it's fun and weird. And just when you're like, I don't really get that joke. That sequence gets really dark and creepy in a hurry. And that's what I love about Bong Joon-ho, is he keeps you on your toes. You think you're like, oh, I know what this movie's going to be for the next hour. Nope, it switches gears like four times.
Well, and so the other main thing that it does that I don't think almost any American movie would or does do is that it switches points of view fairly fluidly between the father and his brother and his sister when it needs to.
Yeah, it almost feels like anthology almost, like different anecdotes.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, it's not like an ensemble drama, you know, where you're kind of intercutting between the different characters as they're going on different missions. It literally is the dad's story for like the first 45 minutes. And then all of a sudden he gets kind of taken out of the story. And now we're going to follow the brother for a little while. And then he does a bunch of stuff. And now we're going to follow the sister for a little while. And she does a bunch of stuff. And then we're going to come back to the dad. And then eventually they all sort of converge at the end. But it's structurally, you know, it's very much not the sort of traditional Sid Field three-act hero's journey bullshit that...
Oh, no, very much not. And that's part of the beauty of it. And just want to throw this in before we go and I forget. If you like this movie and you have not dug in to Bong Joon-ho's other films, you must see Memories of Murder, Mother, Snowpiercer, and Okja. All of them are great in different ways. And he has a new one coming out this year called Parasite, which I've heard amazing things about. It won awards at Cannes and all that, and people are raving about it. So I can't wait to see that. But he is one of my very favorite filmmakers working today, and I will see. I don't even have to know what it's about. If his Bong Joon-ho's name is on it, I will watch it. And it's because of the enthusiasm with which he switches tones. It's scary, but also kind of darkly funny as you're watching people get like swallowed up by this rampaging monster tadpole. And on one hand, the monster is absurd and silly looking in a way. And then in another shot, it's not silly at all. It's freaking scary.
Yeah. And then a couple of times it turns on a dime into being extremely touching and extremely sad.
Yeah. It's the fun, odd dysfunction of the family. You know, the one brother's kind of a drunk and the sister is a world-class archer. And it's like, those are weird touches. You know, like in another film, she'd be a school teacher. But nope, she's a world-class archer. And yes, it comes in handy later on. Yeah. And I just, I don't need a movie to be completely unpredictable to have a good time. Like, I enjoyed Godzilla King of the Monsters quite a bit. Don't think it really threw me for any loops. You know, safe to say that it was fairly conventional. I knew where it was going. A movie like The Host, we've given you like a third of where it goes.
Well, so, yeah, speaking of that, one of the things that didn't work for me on either viewing of this, but even less so, I think, this most recent time, was this whole sort of head fake towards maybe this monster is also causing some sort of disease outbreak. I didn't, like, I remember being sort of confused the first time I watched this, like, okay, wait, is this a monster movie or is this an outbreak movie? And the way it switched between those two things didn't quite work for me.
For me, that to me is the whole political satire, which is Bong Joon-ho wants to take full aim at the emergency services, or AKA the government of South Korea.
Well, and the American military presence in South Korea as well.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Of course. The U.S. military not only created the monster with its own sheer ignorance, but continues to like bullshit people as they're dying on the street.
Right. And I didn't like that. It felt weird to me because they focused all of that energy on this weird sort of disease subplot. But in the meantime, it didn't seem like the American military or the South Korean military had any interest in actually killing this monster. We never see them actually attempt to kill it or to do it, like, and
no,
like,
yeah, I again, I'm sure you grasp this as well, but to me, that's kind of like the whole bureaucracy of it. Like, the satire is they don't know what they're doing. They're going to do this Agent Yellow or whatever they call it, this powder that could kill people, make it worse. But the bureaucracy is just like so convoluted. It doesn't matter as long as it looks like they're trying to do something. Then they're doing their job, you know?
Yeah, but again, like I feel like you could have done that without having to introduce this whole, again, this fake out disease thing. It just, I don't know. It didn't work for me. It just confused me.
Cloverfield has the same thing.
Well, that's weird. So I was going to bring that up too. It was like both of these movies do that.
An interesting connection there that Cloverfield has the, let's call it the not the subplot, but the sub creature, which are the little lice type beasties that fall off of the giant Cloverfield monster. And as we see in a really interesting subway sequence, they're just as dangerous as the giant monster.
Yeah, so one of them mauls Lizzie Kaplan's character, and then she ends up with this disease. And that, to me, was one of the most effective sequences in the movie, is that the aftermath of that, they come out of the tunnel, they're in this military quarantine kind of place, and they realize that she's been bitten by one of these things, and everybody freaks the fuck out, like the whole military and all the doctors, and they pull her behind this screen, and she basically just explodes. We don't see it. We just see sort of blood splattering on this thing. And
oh, yeah. Really well. But I mean, kudos Matt Reeves, because you want to give your audience a nasty visceral shock, but you're definitely sticking for the PG-13. And if those are your two marching orders, you did a good job, because that's a fun sequence. So for you, that whole, like, the sub creature that causes a disease works in Cloverfield, but doesn't work as well in The Host.
Well, it's a minor thing in Cloverfield. It's in a sense, Cloverfield kind of just does it that one time and then drops it. Like, it establishes, I guess, that these things are dangerous, that if you get bit by them, you'll die. And there's a little bit later on when our main characters are sort of battling another group of them, it amps up the peril a little bit. But it's not a thing that, like, they concentrate on and spend a whole lot of shoe leather on only to go, yeah, no, not really.
I like it in both films only because it adds a layer of threat that, okay, if you're 5 miles away, yeah, a giant monster destroying New York City is terrifying. But if you're 5 miles away, you know, you're an observer. But now there's this secondary monster and a tertiary threat, which is now some form of disease. Now you're not safe, you know?
But in The Host, it turns out to not be real. Like, it's made up. It's like the government made it up. It isn't an actual disease.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't know that at the time. All right. So what else in this movie struck you in a scientific way? Do you don't have that problem with the mass and weight junk that you were talking about 15 minutes ago?
Well, this is it's a much, much smaller monster. So no, you don't. Like that, that looks like proportionate to what it would need to be. I mean, you know, again, that's a creature that's of a size that we're used to seeing, right? That is roughly the size of an elephant.
Really. Yeah, about an elephant, right? About so.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what my favorite shot is? Is that Bong Joon-ho, he knows that we've seen every type of monster in the world, and he has a couple of shots in the movie where you're like, what am I looking at? And it's like the shot where the creature is hanging from the bottom of the bridge and then drops into the water like a nasty black teardrop.
Yeah.
You know, just like blurp. And your brain goes, that was weird. I'm not used to seeing that exact image in a monster movie. All right, so what do you have? I don't really have any questions because there's not much science in this movie unless you want to dig into the Agent Yellow that they use, the powder and the disease.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. They don't even give you enough to go on to be able to judge. I mean, clearly you can invent a powder that will suffocate people or creatures or whatever it is.
Talk about mutations caused by human interaction.
Well, so that's the other thing, I guess. So from a scientific point of view, the Cloverfield guy coming from space makes way more sense than a thing like this mutating in a single generation to become this thing, right? Because the way natural selection works is through mutation. And so, like, things mutate, and then, 99.999% of those mutations kill the thing immediately. They're completely unbeneficial, or at best, they're neutral. And then occasionally, some small mutation ends up being advantageous, and over a period of many millions of years, that thing's offspring and its offspring's offspring, et cetera, end up becoming something different. But the idea that like this could happen, like you dump a bunch of chemicals in the thing and then I don't know what, like it changes its DNA and into this giant weird tadpole thing. And now it's a different creature and it didn't just completely kill it. I don't know. It's right. Again, it's a monster movie. You let it go. But
I think you'd agree that the unexplained simplicity of it is part of the joke.
Definitely. Definitely. And again, for this movie, which is in a lot of ways a comedy and a satire, that is as much a commentary on how these monsters are always made in, you know, more serious kaiju movies. One of the other things that jumped out at me, and it's so silly, but it struck me, and this doesn't, I don't think, require a degree in physics at all, but in the very opening of the movie, after they dump the formaldehyde in the thing, there's a scene with a guy standing on a bridge and he looks down and he sees this giant black thing under the water. He can't make out what it is. Obviously, we learn later on it's the monster. But he's up there for whatever reason. He decides he's going to kill himself. And so he's going to jump off this bridge and kill himself. And they show him jump off the bridge and they show the entire bridge and they show him falling off of it. And you look at it and you're like, wait a second, that bridge is not that high. I have literally watched people jump from higher heights than that for fun. And yet this guy jumps feet first into the water from a, 20, 30 feet. And we're expected to believe that that is him attempting to commit suicide.
Well, maybe he can't swim.
I suppose maybe that's it. Which the other thing that struck me this time watching the movie, and I know this is not a science thing, it's just an interesting thing to note. Does it just rain all the time in South Korea? Because like 90% of this movie takes place in like torrential downpour.
A, rain. I think it does rain a lot there. And B, man, what have you ever shot in the rain?
You don't shoot in the rain because it's a pain in the ass.
I know, but it just shows you the effort. They want atmosphere. They want that tone. And they're willing to like make your setups and your takes 10 times harder.
Well, and most of that was not fake, rain tower rain either. Most of that, if you look, you can see it's massive thunderstorms all the way. Like, they're lucky they didn't get struck by lightning while they were shooting.
We're going to break down now into report card mode. Clickety click, clack, click. These are the categories this week: characters, creatures, story, science, entertainment value. Which one wins? On the side of characters, Cloverfield or the host, Steven?
Well, that's not even a contest. Obviously, the host. Again, in the first 5 minutes introduction of this family, I cared more about them than I did anybody in Cloverfield after watching the whole 90-minute movie.
There you go. I concur. Point the host. Creatures. Which film has more impressive creatures?
I like the Cloverfield monster better overall.
Yeah, I mean, I without knocking the host creature, because it's meant to be something somewhat realistic and relatively believable, And that's not to take it away. I do love the look of the Cloverfield monster and its freaky lice offspring, whatever they are.
Like I said earlier, I really like the way that they kind of made it look like a bat, because it was a thing that we hadn't seen before. We've seen giant lizards. We've seen giant mammals, like giant ape-like mammals and Mothras and whatever else. And they did a creature that hadn't been well represented in the kaiju genre.
Well, to be fair, the host creature is like a ridiculously large tadpole with feet. That's kind of unique.
Oh, that was very unique, but yeah.
Story. Which film has the better story?
I don't know. How do you judge story apart from characters and whatever?
Well,
else?
I mean, one story is about, we got to get out of here. Oops, we better go find our friend. And the other is, hey, they took our daughter. We're going to go find her. The host.
I mean, the stories are remarkably similar in that regard.
Yeah, I know. But the host is like legitimately committed to its rescue story from the beginning. And Cloverfield feels a bit more random.
Well, and it's a more compelling story. But it's a more compelling story because the characters are more compelling. So it's hard
right.
to sort of, it's hard to necessarily judge that. And like I said, as pure story, Cloverfield works, right? You're in the moment. It's very visceral.
Yeah, but it's not better. Let's put it this way, Stephen. If you put the Cloverfield characters in the host story is still better.
I mean, I don't know that you can divorce those
okay.
two things. Maybe too pedantic about it. I don't know.
all right. So science, which film has better science?
I'm going to narrowly give it to Cloverfield.
Okay.
Just because the origin of the monster is more believable in Cloverfield than it is in The Host.
Okay. A monster landing in Coney Island from an outer space asteroid that nobody documented or saw is more believable than formaldehyde turning fish into tadpole monsters.
Yes. From a scientific point of view, it is.
The final category, which film offered us more entertainment value?
Definitely The Host.
And it's not a knock on Cloverfield. Like, if I'm rating this on just a film critic scale, Cloverfield is a 4 out of 5-star movie. But The Host is, like, just novel. It's a different, unique spin on a very, very familiar monster movie story. And it's because of the characters and the writing and the look and the rain and the sense of humor. And Cloverfield has a lot of cool assets, but it doesn't have those things. So give me your thoughts. But I think The Host is the much better film.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a very apples and oranges comparison, because I think that Cloverfield is a very visceral, like, you're engaged enough to, like, especially watch it in the theater the first time. Like, it's very much like, oh, okay, like, that found footage has a inherent advantage of the, oh, you're really there kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, The Host, because it's funny and because it is so weird, there's a little bit of a remove, but the characters are so much better and you care about them so much more. And like you pointed out a couple times, like, kind of knew where Cloverfield was going from minute one. And The Host had various twists and turns that were very interesting and compelling. And so, yeah, definitely The Host.
Well, there we go. It's another episode in the can. Thank you for listening. Hey, all, thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed Science vs. Fiction. Hey, Stephen, you know what people can do if they want to support the show?
No, Scott, why don't you tell me what people can do if they want to support the show?
Well, there are several awesome things that you could do. Leave us a review at iTunes, or tweet about us, or Facebook about us, or email your mom and tell her that this is the best podcast ever. You could also sign up for our Patreon account, which will give you bonus episodes like commentaries, interviews, and random fun stuff for nerds. So thanks for listening.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.